Welcome to the Adopting and Fostering Home podcast. Whether your family has been on this journey for years or you're just getting started, we're here to support and encourage you along the way. And now your hosts, Lynette Ezell and Tara Melber.
Hey everyone, thanks for joining us again for the Adopting and Fostering Home podcast. We're picking up again today with Jason Johnson. He is a speaker with the Christian Alliance for Orphans. He was a former church planner, and his latest book is Reframing Foster Care. And so we are picking up that conversation with him today. So thanks for joining us.
You wrote in the book that the gospel compels us to get into foster care. It sustains us in the midst of it, and it manifests itself through the gospel. And that's a perfect picture of it, because it's not an event that occurs and then it's done. It's right. Forever. You are forever into brokenness.
Absolutely. Yes.
Right. Right. And so we in working with church leaders and ministries around the country, we try to help them treat it just like we would marriage. So for the most part, in most churches, if a couple says, hey, pastor, we got engaged and we're excited about getting married, the church leadership response is, hey, that's fantastic. We love that. We love it so much that before you get married, we want you to go through this premarital process. And that takes on a number of different forms in churches, but for the most part, there's typically something. And generally, that premarital process is designed to help couples understand God's design for this, God's heart for marriage, understand their role in this, have realistic expectations going into it, but maybe even more importantly, have the tools and resources and relationships they need to thrive long term. Mm-hmm. You know, the goal isn't, let's do premarital counseling so that you can have the best wedding day possible. No, the goal is,
right.
It's actually to work with couples and help them kind of say, help them think beyond the wedding day, right? Like, hey, our goal here is for a healthy, thriving marriage forever. And so in a similar tone, when we work with church leadership, we help them kind of build out these quote unquote premarital counseling systems in their churches for people who are considering foster care adoption, for the very reason that you just said. This is likely a lifetime commitment. And I'll even take a step back. It may not be the case that someone fosters forever. But if it does turn into an adoptive situation, obviously that's a forever commitment. But maybe even a family who is going to foster for a little while, it's still a lifelong commitment,
right,
for the reasons that we said earlier, because they've seen things they can never unsee, they've felt things they can never unfeel. Like, this stays with them forever. And so what we want to do is help churches build out systems where they can disciple their people long before that quote-unquote marriage, wedding day. And mm-hmm. for me, that wedding day is when we move people into kind of a licensing training process. I want to see churches feel very confident and comfortable with discipling their people. And this is God's heart for this. And this is God's design for this. And understanding your role in this, right? Because we want to have this vetting process to a certain extent where people maybe come in saying, hey, pastor, we're excited. We want to adopt every orphan in Africa. And we go, okay.
Yeah, well, that was me 20 years ago.
Yeah. You know, and we go, on one hand, we say, man, let's take that passion, but let's harness it a little bit.
Right.
Like, let's develop some realistic expectations, understand your role in this. And our goal would be that by the end of this process, maybe people have developed a little more clarity on, you know what, we came into it thinking this, but now we're actually thinking this.
Right,
we go,
right.
Great, right? Because we want you to figure that stuff out before you're walking down the aisle, knowing you shouldn't be walking down this aisle, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we have yet to see churches begin to implement this process and get pushback from families where they go, are you kidding me? I can't believe you're making us jump through more hoops. No, not at all. As a matter of fact, families typically respond with, you know, wow, I'm so grateful that we have a church that wants to walk with us through this and to help us. Because frankly, if an individual or a couple comes and says, here, we feel called to this, we feel called to foster care adoption, that's a really big deal. That's probably the culmination of months, if not years, of kind of private personal consideration. Mm-hmm. And for them to say it out loud is a huge deal.
Yeah, it is.
And then for them to be met with kind of a process that recognizes how big of a deal that is, I think it brings them a lot of comfort. They go, wow, this, it feels so good to know I'm not just going to be thrown to the wolves on this.
Right.
And that I'm going to be walked with and discipled by my church and by people around me. So for the long haul, because it is a lifelong thing in one way, shape, or form or another.
Yeah. You know, while you're on that same train of thought there, my husband's been my pastor. We've been married 34 years. For 25 years, he was my pastor. And so when we were in a church in Louisville, the Lord began to really awaken Kevin and I to the needs of orphans and children in foster care. And I just became consumed with it, Jason. I know Tara was there a few years later. She knows it.
We were partners in crime.
Yeah. And just with the desire to awaken the church, my parents, my sister, everyone. You know, to the suffering of children. I mean, like, you know, charging hell with a water gun, pretty much. And so, you know, I mean, it's all I wanted to talk about. But we didn't have a foster care adoption team or an orderly, productive way of kind of what you were alluding to, of supporting and encouraging families as they started this journey. But looking back, I think I overwhelmed and kind of intimidated a lot of people. Within my own church, my own Sunday school class, my own friend group, who just weren't feeling it yet. You know what I mean? So I think that's why I have shared so many copies. Like, I buy cases of your book, Everyone Can Do Something, and share here in the Atlanta area, because you address this season of when the Lord lays this on my heart, you know, let's don't go be twisting other people's arms. And so we don't want to be, like you've said, counterproductive, overwhelming others with the need, and then they're paralyzed in fear, because I think I've done that in the past.
We spend so much time working with church leadership and organizational leadership on that very topic. How can we communicate this in such a way that it doesn't paralyze people in fear and overwhelm them, but it actually compels them and it helps them see that, yeah, it's a big problem, mm-hmm. but there's a place for me.
Right.
I can do something. Yeah. I mean, so that mantra of everyone can do something has become increasingly important, that we want church leaders to be able to stand in front of their churches and with confidence and with clarity feel like they can truly communicate to the entirety of their body. You know, we're not all called to do the same thing, but we are all capable of doing something, and we want to help you find your something.
So how do we approach our church staff and others with the needs of the fatherless and children in the foster system? What are ways that we can shrink the problem down to where it seems like we could do something? It compels us to do, hey, I could do that.
Right. Like, I can buy a bag of diapers.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we do a lot of trainings and workshops on that very thing, of the idea of everyone can do something, and shrinking the problem is one of the modules that we probably spend the most time on. And so what we've found is we've distilled it down to really three primary ways that we can, quote unquote, shrink the problem. And I'll start with number one, which is this idea of making a big problem feel small. And right. So the illustration we use often is my favorite restaurant, likely one of yours, everyone's favorite restaurant. When I'm in Canada, they bemoan it because it's not in Canada yet, but they drive down into the States to go to Chick-fil-A. Everybody
That's
loves
great.
Chick-fil-A. And you're there in the home of Chick-fil-A.
Yes, actually, yes, we are.
So let's use Chick-fil-A as an example. And the number one value meal I've learned, a good friend of mine's an operator. I went to his kind of induction ceremony into the corporation. It was really beautiful, but one of the guys there shared that the number one value meal is their most lucrative item on the menu, the sandwich, fries, and the drink. That's
hence and he was, number he one.
Was, the number, number one.
He was talking about their identity as a company. He said, this is who we are. We are the chicken sandwich, right? And this is the core of who we are. And it struck me that, wow, it's interesting. They make more money off of that meal than anything else. And what I knew was that that meal was actually one of the most unhealthy items on the menu. And so I don't want to ruin it for everybody. But the fact is, it doesn't matter. We're still going to eat there because it's so good. And that's actually the point. Because what research shows is that when people don't understand big data, they discard it very quickly. And so the illustration we use is if you came to me and said, I need to lose 15 pounds, I'd say, well, what do you eat every day? And you'd say, well, like everyone else in America, I eat Chick-fil-A every day, right? And I'd say, well, that's actually, that's really unhealthy. That meal alone is about 1,100 calories. And you'd say to me, yeah, but it tastes so good. And I'd say, you're right, but it's 1,100 calories. And then you'd say, but what's a calorie really? Because who's ever tasted one or held one or seen one? Nobody, ever. Nobody really even knows what they are. The average person can't define what a calorie is. We have no human experience with it. And then when you say there's 1,100 of them, we are naturally hardwired to just discard that information. I don't even know what that means. I don't know what that looks like. I have no human experience with that. I'm going to discard it for the sake of my own personal satisfaction. Meaning I'm going to continue to order the number one value meal because I don't really understand how unhealthy it is, right? Now, to distill that down or to shrink that problem, we could say the equivalent of eating 1,100 calories for lunch is about 4 Snickers bars. So on a calorie level, it's about the same. If you eat a number one value meal, on a calorie level, you're basically eating 4 candy bars. And then suddenly it becomes a little more gross, right?
Because we're all like, just all kind of mouthing that to Lynette. Yeah, that's gross.
That's good. Yeah.
Is that with a Diet Coke? Or?
Because we all kind of conceptually understand, we've been trained to understand it's unhealthy to eat 4 candy bars,
right?
Because we can relate to them. We understand 4. We know what they feel like. We've had an experience with candy bars. So we've gone from 1,100 things that nobody really understands to 4 things that everybody understands.
Yeah.
But we haven't minimized the problem. It's still the same problem. And so when we talk about shrinking the problem, number one, we're talking about how we advocate. And generally speaking, when we talk about how there's 450,000 kids in foster care system, 100,000 kids waiting for adoption, and we use these big, big numbers, I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't let people know about the reality of what's going on. What I am suggesting is that research shows those kinds of numbers that are intangible and that people can't really relate to actually become more counterproductive than good, right? People discard them very, very quickly because they say that just seems so big and so overwhelming. I don't even know what to do or where to start.
That is so true.
I'm going to let somebody else deal with that. And so the burden on us is how do we contextualize those numbers? And so I get to work with agencies, organizations around the country that are doing really good work on this, where they're saying, you know what? Yes, there's 450,000 kids in the United States foster care system, but let's look at a 15-mile radius from your church in North Atlanta. Like, what's going on right there? So that church leaders can then communicate or ministry leaders can communicate to their people, hey, you know what? The problem is big around the country, but let's focus on what's going on right here in our own backyard.
I love that.
And then you might discover, okay, we've worked with local agencies and DHS, and we've discovered that they need, let's say, 15 more licensed homes. Okay. Well, maybe our church has the capacity to solve that problem immediately, or maybe it opens up opportunities for us to collaborate with other churches and to say, hey, you know what? We want to set a goal for our church that we raise up 5 new homes. And maybe you guys can raise up 5 new homes, and then another church can raise up 5 new homes, and collaboratively together, we can address this problem. Collaboratively together, we can open a foster pantry. Like, we don't need we don't need 10 in our county.
Right.
Let's do one that's really good and let's do it together, right? Collaboratively together, we can do foster care at night out events. We can do nights of encouragement. We can do meals, right? So let's just shrink the problem down in a way that people understand. So that's number one. Number two is communicating that everyone can do something message. Mm-hmm. And that's just simply rooted in scripture. That's the theology of the body of Christ, that we are ears and eyes and hands and feet and toes, right? We're not all called to do the same thing, but we're all capable of doing something. And we all don't have the same function, but we function for the same purpose. That's the good of the body. And so what that means is that we can stand in front of our people and say, look, some of you God is going to call to open your home to children. Others of you, he's not. But that doesn't mean there's not a space for you. And then we want to encourage them to consider what their something might be. So, for example, I live here in Texas in a huge college town. We have upwards of 70,000 college students that live in our relatively small town. That means that half of our churches are filled with college students. Half of everything is college students. And so what we can't do is stand in front of a normal crowd here in our city and say, look, if you really love Jesus, you'll bring kids into your home. No, because literally half of the people in that audience legally mm-hmm. cannot. And so we have to contextualize a message that says, look, we're not all called to do the same thing. We're all capable of doing something. And then we want to share those stories. We want to share the stories of people who bring children into their home, but we also want to share the stories of people who are finding other unique and creative ways to support those families, whether it's bringing meals or babysitting. A story I share often is the story of a guy in Kansas City I met a couple of years ago who owns a barbecue restaurant. And he is a member of a church, and he's told his church that anytime there's a foster parent function at the church, whether it's a night of encouragement or families bring new placements into their home, his restaurant is going to be the first there donating the best barbecue in Kansas City for free. And those are his words, the best barbecue in Kansas City.
Love
and so,
that.
He has delivery drivers. He sends them over to foster parents' homes when there's a new placement and they deliver a meal. And so here's a guy who said, look, I know what I can't do, mm-hmm. but I know what I can do.
Right.
I can barbecue. I can barbecue better than anybody. And I'm going to use my business and my restaurant for the good of the body, for the good of the whole. And that's where we really encourage people to get creative and to think outside the box a little bit. So real quick, I'll finish. We shrink the problem. Mm-hmm. Into relatable terms, we empower people with the idea that everyone can do something, ears, eyes, hands, feet, toes, and then we develop kind of tiered on-ramps for them. This is the structure that helps support everything that we've just said. If it's true that everyone can do something, how do I actually do that in our church or in our ministry? And that's where we talk about tiered on-ramps. And what that means is, if you think of it as a highway and you have different on-ramps into that highway, we need more than one on-ramp. We need a few. And we need some on-ramps that are a little easier to navigate and some on-ramps that are a little more difficult. So here's what I mean. Let's say tier one is super low-hanging fruit. This is things like bringing a meal or praying or donating supplies, right? Everyone can do something. And then someone says, well, I can't foster. And we say, well, there's other less commitments, opportunities for you to get engaged. And someone says, well, but I can't cook. I can't bring a meal. And we can say, great. Order something from their favorite restaurant and deliver it to them. And mm-hmm. they say, I don't have a car. I can't drive. We say, no problem. Order it online and have Uber deliver
it. Exactly. Right? Like, yes.
So we're constantly kind of shrinking it down to the point where, and here's what we say about tier one. Tier one is, it's so easy, it's almost harder not to do it, right, is what we're telling people. It's when I tell my kids to clean their room and they argue with me for an hour. And I say, you know what, the hour that you've not done what I asked you to do, you could have already been done, right? It's it's that easy. It's easier for you to do it than to not do it. So that's tier one. Tier two, a little more commitment. Let's say it's babysitting or financial support or, you know, fill in the blanks with whatever works for your church, your ministry. And then tier three is kind of your highest level commitments. And that doesn't mean that these are more committed people than tier one. What I mean by that is it requires a little bit more. So that's training to become a foster parent, training to become CASA or Safe Families or Respite. So extensive amounts of training we typically categorize in that. And now when we say to our church and our ministry, everyone can do something, we have a system, a structure that actually supports that, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
We have different on-ramps that support that message.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. We have a ministry here, Tara and I got started, just called Restoring Dignity, and we want foster kids that we hear about, that we can help, that we can drive to have new clothing. Mm-hmm. We want it to be new. So we have a lady, and what she does is she just buys new PJs all year long. All year long, she buys new pajamas. Now, that, you know, she gets people to help her. She goes to business, says, "Will you buy pajamas for a foster kid? Brand new. We only want brand new. No junk for Jesus," right? And so she does that for us. Her senior adult mom sits and rolls those and puts a scripture of encouragement on those for the children. Now, that's huge for me, you know, that this lady is willing to do that. And her senior adult mom sits there and rolls those and puts a pretty ribbon on them. Mm-hmm. And brings them to us, it really helps keeps our arms lifted, because we're still kind of just, you know, that ministry is just maybe a tier two,
right?
You know, and because we do get to take those to the kids or the families and get to help the families a little more. But, you know, it just, when we stepped into it, and then the Lord said, "Hey, there's more people out here you don't know about who will come along and help you."
Awesome. Yeah.
Well, Jason, it's been a fascinating conversation today, and we really look forward to having you again. There's just so much. I don't even feel like we've scratched the surface, but there's so much more to discuss and just for the Lord to teach us about foster care and adoption and the role of the church and how to love others more deeply. So we would appreciate if you would join us again on the podcast so that we can let others hear all that the Lord has taught you on this journey.
Absolutely. It's been a joy to talk to you guys. Thank you.
Thanks.
You have been listening to the Adopting and Fostering Home, a resource of the North American Mission Board. For more information about today's podcast and other relevant resources, visit sendrelief.org.